The following is a Radiovisions presentation.
The Donald Berkness Story begins with this letter. Headquarters, 526th Bombardment Squadron, Army Air Force, Station 117, APO 557. 11 March, 1945. Dear Mrs. Berkness, Donald was the nicest son any mother ever had. It may have been his youth, or that slow, precise way he talked, or the way he looked you right in the eye. I don't know just what it was that made that boy so appealing. His failure to return hit me harder than any other. First of all, your son was flying in the lead ship. Wing lead, I believe, for another group in another combat wing. The ship was hit, and 9 chutes were seen. A lead aircraft carries 10 men as a crew, but Donald was the man nearest the escape hatch and should have made it. You may or may not know that Donald was a special equipment operator, and a very good one. He was always being sent out to other groups to fly with them until they could train special equipment men of their own. This work necessitated being flown to the field from which he was to fly at ungodly hours, waiting over there until briefing time and returning with his ship that night after interrogation. You can see that such a schedule carried out over several days could soon become exhausting. Donald did it for 4 straight prior to being shot down. On the morning before his last flight, he was talking to the group executive and said, in that haunting way of his, "Colonel, I'm so tired, I don't know what to do. Last night, I didn't get to bed at all because they wouldn't give me a bed at the field I went to. In fact, I had to sit in a chair all night." You can imagine how that made me feel, since I heard the story only after he had been reported MIA. I should like to have a squadron full of men like him. I feel confident he's alive, and I insist you feel likewise. Sincerely, John R. Martin, Major, Air Corps Commanding.
My daughter kept wanting me to write down my story about what happened to me. They were going to take me to where the plane went down. I never wanted to go to the air base, wanted to go back. The day that I was shot down, we were attacking a bridge across the Rhine River at Cologne, which was about 30, 40 miles behind the lines. The Battle of the Bulge was going on at that point in time, and in order to not fly directly over the Battle of the Bulge, we went into Germany 40, 50 miles further than we normally might have under other circumstances, and our bomb run was back towards the Allied lines, and then instead of going directly over the lines, we went south 40 or 50 miles before we were going to turn and head back towards England. Everything went well during the bomb run and dropping the bombs, but then about 15 minutes after we dropped the bombs, we were hit by anti-aircraft fire, by this shell that came right close to our number one engine. The plane got racked with a lot of shell fragments. The pilot lost control of the ship and asked for a crew check. It usually started in the bombardier in the first, and then we'd work back towards the tail. And the bombardier said, "I'm okay." Just at that time, I noticed this fluid squirting out, and I said, "The hydraulic lines cut." And just then, it ignited, and the whole area underneath the pilot's compartment where the escape hatch was located started on fire. The pilot said, "Get out of this SOB." I was the closest to the escape hatch, so I disconnected my oxygen mask, released my armor protection, grabbed my parachute pack, went in and pulled the release and popped the door off. I jumped out with the pack in my hand. After a few seconds, you have an acceleration, so you feel you're falling for a short period of time, but all of a sudden you remember you're supposed to stick your legs out and keep from spinning around. So I did, and I started kind of dropping head first. I remember I could look up and I saw the plane up above me with flames coming out of the bomb bay. So then I realized I was in a situation where I had to get my parachute fastened in my harness. I couldn't see the rungs of the parachute pack. I had to take my gloves off. Then I had to try to connect my parachute pack to the harness. So I was doing that, seemed like quite a while, and then I went into the clouds, but I couldn't tell for sure, but I finally realized that I was going to have to pull the chute and hope that it was on. I thought it was, which I did, thank goodness, because it did pop open, and I only swung three times before I hit the ground. It must have been about a minute and a half or 2 minutes. It ended up saving my life because the other navigator and the bombardier had opened their chutes right away, and they were both shot, whereas I was captured and taken back as a POW. Well, I was captured immediately. I landed, I'd say, maybe 150 yards from a small road. It was hilly, rural country. There was sort of trees and open farmland. There were 20 soldiers that were walking along the road. When they saw me, they yelled for me to surrender and raise my hands, which I did. Just at that time, the German officer came tooling up in a motorcycle with a sidecar on it. He took over, and I sort of became his prisoner, and he had me get in the sidecar. Then we went off down the road, maybe 5 miles. He took me to a farmhouse, and we went in, and it turned out that it was a German headquarters. It was right close to where the plane that I was in had crashed, because you could see the smoke from the plane coming up behind the buildings. They had us wait outside to see the officer in charge, and we went in after a few minutes. He looked like a Prussian general. He had rouge, and his face was all made up, rouge and almost like lipstick and everything. So I was kind of shocked to see this sort of facial makeup, but he was very strong authority, and he was madder than hell at this officer who brought me there. I couldn't tell what he said. It was because he didn't shoot me, that's what I think, but I don't know for sure. Eventually they brought me over to the house next door, which was a farmhouse. The upstairs of the farmhouse, there was a bunch of German GIs, and they had me stay up there for a while. They just ignored me. They were friendly. For the most part, they were older German soldiers that were 60s and 70 years old. So I was there for a couple hours, and a couple of more militaristic-type soldiers came and put me in a staff car. We started down the road. We went probably about 10 miles. And there were all these German troops walking along the road and heading up towards the front. It was quite a traffic jam. We finally went into these woods, and there were a lot of soldiers hiding out in the woods. And it must have been part of the Siegfried line, because we parked and the officer got up and they went into a hole in the ground, an entryway. One of them stayed with me in the car. And they were gone about half an hour maybe. And they came back. We got in the car, and they drove me all the way back to this farm where we started, which is a little unnerving. They put me back upstairs in this room again. Then about 9 o'clock at night, I came again, and we got back in the station wagon, and they drove me about another half an hour in another direction. And we finally got to this town. They dropped me off at a house, and there was a soldier there, and they assigned me to the soldier, and he was there with his wife and a kid. They had me sit there while they ate, and the wife was obviously unhappy that I was there. She was yelling at him about it. And after a while, he finished, and he took me out and put me on a truck with about 10 other German soldiers. This was like midnight. So we went on this truck for about 10, 15 miles. We arrived at a kind of a warehouse facility, which I realized was being used as a prisoner camp. It was a little unnerving because as we walked up, there were two dead soldiers laying right by the door where they'd just been shot. I was put in a room. There were about 20 officers there. All the officers were one room, and then next door there was a warehouse that was two floors, and there were about 1,500 GIs that were in the building. Then it turned out that I ended up being the senior officer. I was a flight officer. There was a second lieutenant there who was senior to me, but he was so sick he couldn't get up. Actually, the fellow who was running it was a senior tech sergeant. He had been there for a while, and he knew what was going on. So I said, whatever you're doing, I'm supporting you, and we'll do whatever we're doing together. And that's how it went for the first few days. Well, as there, I guess, about 3 or 4 days, we were under pressure to sign some papers about how these guys got shot that had been lying out in the snow. These individuals had been working a number of days and a number of shifts repeatedly. They'd been called out to work on this detail, and then they'd come back and they'd be called out on that detail. And they'd been on so many details, they were exhausted. And when the guard came in to demand that they come out for another work detail, they were reluctant to come out because they felt they were overworked already and they were too tired to go. And the guard got mad because they were standing back, and so he just hauled off and shot them. We got involved in a conflict with the guards there, but they wanted us to say that they had refused orders, and so we made them change the words to our liking. There was about maybe 150 of us were rounded up and marched back into Germany. We marched about 120 miles. It took about a week. It was mountainous and there was a lot of snow, and I don't remember ever eating except we'd eat the snow. I don't remember ever getting any food. I didn't have any shoes. All I had were my flying boots on. So I had problems with my legs because I had to lift my legs up high to go through the snow, and so my legs got to be very stiff after a while. Whenever we'd stop or a break, my legs would tighten up and I'd need some help. But it turned out that during this walk, I got talking to some of the guys and realized that four of the guys that were on the tail of the plane with me were also in the group. Now, I hadn't initially recognized them because I didn't really know this crew that I was flying with. I'd fly to these fields and fly with the crew and then I'd fly back. I never had met the guys that were in the tail of the plane until I'd realized we were there together in this march. We arrived at Lindbergh. At that point, the officers were separated from the other group and sent down to an interrogation center about 20 miles south of Frankfurt. They put us on a train. We went down to Frankfurt, went through the station, got on another train, and went down to this interrogation center where I was put into a solitary confinement and then interrogated a number of times. I was mainly worried about them finding out that I was a special equipment operator. They never figured that out. In the process, they did threaten to shoot me with a pistol, but I kept trying to act in a way cooperative in the sense that I'd tell them, yeah, we bombed Cologne. They put me in a small box, I'd say like maybe 6 feet square and about 2 feet high, and there was another guy in there too. And then I put the top on, it was pitch black. We got talking and I said, well, why don't you tell me about your life story and I'll tell you about my life story. So he told me his life story, and he was an Australian and he had left Australia in 1938. He was engaged and he hadn't had a chance to see his girlfriend since 38. And he was hoping to get a letter from her soon. And that went on and on and on and for quite a long time. And just about the time he finished telling me his life story, they let us out of the box, so I never got around to telling him mine. So that was the end of that. The bad thing was that when we left, we were taken down to the train station, and we had to wait about 3 hours to catch the train to leave there. They were taking us to an interrogation center, and at that point in time, I froze my feet. So from that point on, I had the problem of a frozen foot. Anyway, they took us on a train up to another interrogation center. They sort of check you over for proper clothing and shoes and that sort of stuff. And then I was put on a train to go to a prison camp that was up close to Bering Sea. I knew of the camp because my uncle was a prisoner there, so I was looking forward to getting to this camp. We were in this boxcar. It was quite a sad situation because it was extremely crowded in the boxcar. So crowded that some people always had to be standing. There wasn't enough room for everyone to sit down at the same time. I'd say about a third or more were wounded or had something wrong with them. A number of them were unable to even stand up at all. A lot of people had to stand up almost half the time. Six guards took half the boxcar and the prisoners were on the other half. That went on for about 10 days. It turned out that the Russians decided to sweep across Poland at that point in time. And so all of the train schedules got disrupted and they took our engine away. They ended up parking us in the railroad yards in Berlin. So we spent 4 or 5 days in the railroad yards in Berlin without an engine. We'd get bombed and the Germans would lock us in the boxcar and go to an air raid shelter. Eventually they decided to take us to a camp that was right about 20 miles south of Berlin. Where we ended up was a camp by Luchtenwalde. The air raids on Berlin were really something to see. The British would come over at night. You could see the anti-aircraft guns floating, and every now and then your plane would go down in flames or blow up. And then during the day, the 8th Air Force would come over and bomb Berlin or bomb other cities around the vicinity. So it was really quite an air show, to put it mildly. It turns out there had been the Great Escape, the famous Great Escape, from a British camp. As a consequence from the Great Escape, the Germans had changed their policy from just recapturing prisoners to one of killing the prisoners if they were recaptured. And it turned out that a lot of them were at Buchenwald, but they hadn't been the ones that had gotten out and were shot, but they were involved in digging the hole and planning it and all that sort of thing. As a result of the Germans changing their policy and shooting the prisoners there, the instructions from the Allied forces to the prisoners were that you should not try to escape, because if you did and you were captured, you would get killed. Well, it was a very large camp by Luchtenwalde. There were maybe 10,000 Russians that went into the camp. There were 4,000 or 5,000Britishers, 2,000 or 3,000 American GIs. There were about 2,000 British officers. There were about 500 American officers. The American officers and the British officers were together in the same compound. We had a lot of interesting interaction with them. They were on the ball. They were very gracious in a lot of ways. It turned out that one of the fellows that I had met there, his name was Don Himmler. He was an American soldier who had got captured at Monte Cassino. Well, he had got to know a lot of these Britishers. He had been there quite a while. And it turned out that I had my 20th birthday in this camp. And So he had told the guys that were involved in the Great Escape that it was my birthday. So they had a surprise birthday party for me. And they made me a birthday cake out of potatoes. You couldn't believe it didn't taste like potatoes. It tasted like regular cake. And it looked like a regular cake. So they were a very ingenious bunch. But they were always doing something very spectacular. Like, I remember one day it was raining and it was cold. Every day we were supposed to stand outside and be counted. And the American officers were in one line up and the British were in another. So we went over to count the British, with a couple of thousand of them. First it'd be 2002, and then it'd be 1998 or something, you know. And so they get more and more frustrated, and finally they call in more soldiers and more soldiers, and they ended up finally deciding that they couldn't count them by just having more soldiers there accurately. They were worried about an escape, so they ended up deciding that they have to take them one at a time from one enclosure to the other. So it took them all day long. But that's the way the British were. They made them stand out in the rain all day long, counting them. When the war came to a conclusion and the Germans all left, the prisoners took over the camp, and we liberated the warehouses, and the warehouses had Red Cross parcels in them. We then sat there for a couple of weeks waiting to get out. The Allies were still 100 miles away when the war ended. So it turned out that three other guys and myself, we actually broke out of this camp and decided to try to walk back to the Allied lines. We then got down to the Elbe River, and there were four of us. We managed to hire a guy to row us across the Elbe River. We spent one night in a farmhouse, and we then made arrangement with the farmer to sleep in his barn. The farmer and his very young grandson, apparently, came in and were talking. I couldn't understand German, but one of the fellows I was with did. And the boy said, we should get a gun and shoot him. The grandfather said, those days are over, son. Those days are over. But we were so concerned that we took turns, one of us staying awake. The next day we got back to the American lines. Let me say in conclusion, I got back to the American lines. They tooled a truck up and took us over to a medical facility and brought us to a cafeteria. And it was 1:05. And the truck driver said, just in time for lunch. And the guy running the mess hall said, it's too late, no more chow. You have to wait till dinner time. So I knew I was back. I still correspond with the tail gunner. It was a tail gunner who I actually was in the plane that I was shot down with it, where we were on the march together. But most of those fellows that did survive, like the pilot, is still alive, but quite ill. And most of them are passed on.
This has been a Radio Visions presentation. Our special thanks to Don Berkness for his participation. To Don's daughter, Patricia Lobsher, for encouraging him to tell his story, and to all members of the Berkness family. To 8th Air Force veteran Aid Shawastik for the program idea and coordination. To Marion Hoffman, tail gunner who shared Don's prisoner of war experience, and the National Capital Area Chapter of the 8th Air Force Historical Society. The Donald Berkness Story was produced and directed by Charles Langdon. Engineering by Ed Myers. This is Lee Shepard speaking.